From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll look back at President Trump's State of the Union address last night and how it might speak to Wisconsin.
Later, a Southern California hip-hop choreographer creates a performance based on Sherman Park.
Contributor Kyle Cherrick says Milwaukee's dining scene should never be just about the hip, trendy spot that just opened.
I'm not saying don't go to the new places, because we need that energy. They're beloved. People are working very hard. But when you're thinking about where should we go, for many people, it's being a tourist in your own town.
And Milwaukee's spiritual tones try to leave their own mark on gospel music.
So we don't want to keep it the same. So we want to come and mix it up. So when we go other places, we will stick with them like, oh, I like they sound. They sound different.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. President Trump delivered his first State of the Union address on Tuesday night, a little more than a year after he took office. The president sought to give himself and his administration credit for the improving U.S. economy and the tax overhaul passed in the last year.
He also laid out his plan for the year ahead, seeking to tie a solution to the DACA program to increased border security and calling for a comprehensive infrastructure plan. Lily Gorin joins us in the studio now. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mitch. Happy to be here.
Well, let me ask you this. A lot of analysts today are talking about the tone of President Trump's speech, or at least some key parts of it. And by that, they're talking about the calls for bringing the country together. How do you see that tone and that message in the context of the president's first year in office?
Well, I mean, a State of the Union address is playing to a number of audiences. And part of what you saw last night is he's pitching a speech to the people in the audience immediately in front of him in Congress. And so there was a call to bipartisanship with regard to Democrats and Republicans who were sitting in front of him on a couple of policy areas. He was also pitching it to the people who are watching at home. And the people who are watching it at home tend to be partisans of whoever giving the speech. And so in that regard, it was certainly not a traditional Trump stump speech that he gives to his base in, an airplane hangar someplace in Kentucky or Alabama or Ohio or Arizona. But it certainly was not necessarily a speech that everybody in the United States watched. State of the Union addresses have been declining in ratings, and there is definitely a partisan skew. Democrats watch President Obama, Republicans tuned out. Republicans are watching President Trump, Democrats are tuning out.
Well, so if President Trump is by most measures an unconventional president, did this feel to you like a pretty conventional kind of address?
It was a fairly conventional State of the Union address. And again, this is the second time we've seen President Trump in the well of the House. He gave a speech to the joint session of Congress, which was not technically a State of the Union address last year. And so, again, this is a different kind of setting than we usually see him in terms of speaking broadly and to a degree without necessarily a, quote, fan base. Certainly there were applause lines and lots of them, but it's not the same as giving a campaign rally speech. So it was a conventional speech delivered by, as you say, an unconventional type of president.
The speech, of course, comes at the beginning of what will likely be another intense election year. The midterm elections are about 9 months away. How does a speech like this set the election year in motion?
Well, a State of the Union addresses, generally speaking, are opportunities for presidents to outline budget priorities, policy priorities that they want Congress to take up. And to some degree, in an election year, you have a really condensed window to do some of that kind of work, because Republicans and Democrats are going to be positioning themselves for the midterms, and they're not necessarily going to want to spend all that much time making a lot of deals. And so one of the difficulties with regard to this speech, there was clarity with regard to his immigration policy proposal, which is is to some degree the same one that he laid out last week. But with regard to a lot of the other areas, things like the opioid crisis and paid maternity leave, paid family leave, there wasn't a lot of detail. And so for Congress to take up those issues during an election year, usually there has to be much more of an impetus from the White House.
Why do you think the Democratic Party chose Massachusetts Congressman Joe Kennedy to deliver the response?
He's young. I'm going to go with he's young.
yeah, he looked like, honestly, about 12.
He's young. And, you know, he's a Kennedy. So to some degree, there's a brand name association with it. It's a thankless job. We've had lots of Democrats and Republicans kind of have a really difficult time with this response. You cannot recreate the grandeur and symbolic nature of a president standing in front of Congress with the vice president and the Speaker of the House behind him. It just is kind of a thankless task. And one wonders if at a certain point the opposition party will give it up, except that it's an opportunity to get, you know, usually about 20 minutes of airtime and somewhat of an audience.
Democrats in recent years have been a little reluctant to put the Northeast front and center as the face of the party, but as you say, the response is always kind of taken with a grain of salt.
Yeah, and again, it was, you know, it's a Kennedy, so there's brand connection there. Young Kennedy that many people don't know. He's a third term congressperson from a sort of a more industrial and mechanized area of Massachusetts. Fall River is really a kind of not necessarily advanced part of the state in terms
this
of—
This is not Cambridge.
It's certainly not Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's not Boston, and it's not necessarily the 128 corridor. And so there was, you know, the symbolic sort of situation where he's framed in an auto shop at a technical college with an audience. And I actually think that the audience was helpful in terms of the delivery of the speech, because a lot of these are just without an audience in front of a camera, and it's very awkward.
Well, you know, with the setting of that speech in mind, and thinking back to the State of the Union address itself, did you see anything in either of these speeches you thought would resonate especially well in Wisconsin?
Again, there's a discussion with regard to infrastructure in the president's speech. There's been a lot of discussion for the entire first year of the Trump administration with regard to infrastructure package. In the speech a year ago, he talked about $1 trillion budget. Now it's $1.5 trillion budget, I believe. And this is, again, stuff that we're talking about in Wisconsin with regard to our transportation budget, with regard to development around the Foxconn deal. There's a lot of interest across the country with regard to infrastructure. But one of the difficulties I think that the Trump administration has had with this is that they haven't put a lot of form to what exactly that $1.5 trillion will be directed towards. And so in Wisconsin, I want to know if we're going to finish some of the road packages that are halfway constructed, because I spend time driving to Waukesha.
So for a guy who expresses himself a lot in tweets, which are fairly limited in length, this was a pretty long speech.
It was a very long speech. It was a long speech in delivery, although apparently not as long a speech in words. It was all, I think it was about an hour and a half delivery. And there were many applause lines, which, again, slows down a president's speech, particularly in this format. But I think the count was about 5,600 words, less than 6,000 words. And it came in as the second or third longest speech that has been sort of timed behind Bill Clinton, who always was long.
I knew what you expected.
So it seemed like they were 3 or 4 hours long. But it wasn't as long in words as Bill Clinton's longer State of the Union address, which were closer to 9 and 10,000 words. So it was a sort of a slow delivery in terms of enunciating and articulating the words and taking pauses. And again, some of them were applause pauses, but it was definitely a longer speech.
Lily Gorin, thanks for helping us talk about what was in the speech and what was not in the speech. And I'm sure we will talk with you again.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me today.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. You can find more of NPR's coverage of the State of the Union address and the Democratic response at wuwm.com.
Next on the show, the choreographer of a hip-hop performance about Sherman Park that's part of UWM's Winter Dances. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Tomorrow through Sunday, UWM's Dance Department presents its annual Winter Dances, an event that showcases the work of faculty and students. This year, there is also a guest choreographer. Southern California hip-hop choreographer D. Sabella Grimes is on the faculty at USC and is a Rockefeller Fellow.
He's been working with dance students here to create a hip-hop piece about Sherman Park. It's called Bubbling Utterances, and if Sherman Park is where black and white coexist in Milwaukee, D. Sabella Grimes explains that this performance is where historically black and white dance forms intersect.
Yeah, I don't know if I think about bringing dance, but definitely an approach to dance and dance making, and dance making being the living practice of what it means to do hip-hop dance. So primarily, I say that I draw from a very vital source, which is black social and black vernacular dance practices, which, you know, for the most part is still informing whether people call it hip hop or not. Some people call what's happening right now lit dances, but there is a living, vibrant, creative practice, a very living and vibrant systems of intelligence, corporeal intelligence, embodied intelligence that happen in these dance practices. And that's the wellspring that I draw from in creating hip-hop dance.
How does that differ from the more, quote-unquote, traditional dance forms and practices and sort of vocabulary, that body vocabulary that a lot of Western dance draws from?
Well, I would say that this recenters a different sort of voice, which I really love about hip hop. And I love this about hip hop internationally, is there is an idea of dance that lives in a very white and Western sort of point of view. And there are just a lot of choreographers and artists like myself that are bringing other sort of voices to the center and just committed to that. And for me, it's also a research practice. You know, one of the ethos of hip hop is knowledge of self. And so how do I learn about myself? And who am I? You know, who am I unfolding into being right now? And dance is a great way to articulate my immaterial and material identities.
One of the things I love about watching hip hop informed dance is that it is so wonderfully physical, and that everybody gets to participate in that in some way. One of my complaints about the white standard dance is that men get to be athletic and physical, but women don't. They get to be beautiful and ethereal. And men don't get to be beautiful and ethereal, and women don't get, you know, and it's like I've always had trouble with that. And one of the things I love about watching what you do and what choreographers who are drawing from that well that you are drawing from do is that everyone has this wonderful physicality and that they can express themselves through it.
Yeah, there is such layered ideas of physicality that happen in hip-hop dance and so much nuance at the same time, which is what I love to focus on when I create concert dance, as they call it, because most of the time I'll run into people and they're like looking for the blow-up moves, the head spin, the whatever sort of big quote-unquote virtuosic move. And yet, you know, being a practitioner, being someone that does this, it's really nice to really kind of bring out the nuance and stretch it a little bit and expand it and, you know, really look at the different shades, colors, and textures of what's happening in hip-hop dance. And what's really nice about working with artists, performers, dancers that aren't necessarily literate in the vocabulary.
Your vocabulary.
Yes, yeah. Yes, in these sort of forms, is that what's hip-hop, you know, and those are finger quotes that I just did in the studio, finger quotes, what's hip-hop about it is the approach and the methodology. What's really important about that is at the core of hip-hop to me is hip-hop dance, and hip-hop actually creative practices is improvisation. When I talk about knowledge of self, is understanding your body and how it flows through the worlds, yeah? And how your body is perceived, yeah? In a variety of different spaces. There's a certain consciousness that comes with hip-hop. And this goes to if a graffiti artist. So for my last project, I worked with this guy, Pose 2, a.k.a. Max Moses. And we just talk about the physicality of graffiti. So someone that used to ride on trains and would always have this sort of, like, he's developed this sort of sensitivity, this sensiness, where he's, I just made that word up, sensiness. And, well, you know, if you're painting on a train and you're looking over your shoulder and you're in between trains, there's something that's very physical about that.
Oh, so immediate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so there's so many different aspects of hip-hop culture, even the art and the craft of being an MC. And it's the same thing in dance. And they all draw from each other.
This comes from Black culture, Black American culture particularly. And there are a lot of white people who have taken this on. Do you celebrate that? Do you celebrate that people are, you know, embracing this who are not part of the culture originally? Or does it feel like they're trying to appropriate it?
I think for real hip-hop practitioners, people that live this culture, that's not even a conversation. There might be a moment in time that people get checked. And that's one thing I love about hip-hop, too. It's very Afro-diasporic. So one of the creation stories about hip-hop, of course, is located in New York. And in New York, you're talking about when we say Latino, we're saying it in a different way than where I come from in California, right? So there's different communities. So the Puerto Rican community, Dominican community, the other Caribbean, you know, sort of conversations, this cross-pollination of ideas that would be part of the African diaspora, right? And so when I say Black, I'm talking about consciousness. I'm also talking about modalities. So there's people now all over the world that travel, and there are these sort of modes of discourse that we would consider like African aesthetics or African-American or Afro-diasporic modes of discourse that people are participating in, and you don't necessarily have the complexion.
And it's not even so much a complexion. I was thinking more of it as a cultural thing where the idea of, okay, let's use jazz as an example. And it was an African-American art form. It came out of that. It was that expression. But the culture in the United States, it wasn't until white people started playing it in some way, shape, or form, and of course it morphed and changed, that it became more acceptable, if that's the right word even, and that people who weren't part of the original conversation found a way into it. And so that's where my question was coming from. Not so much the color of the skin, but the culture that those modalities come from.
I would have to say that people that are steeped in the practice of hip-hop globally, they're a part of the culture. And beyond that, there is, you know, there's always going to be very inclusive sort of environments, you know, types of understanding that will come from experience that are just rooted in the Black experience in this country. And no matter how, what the commerce of jazz, for example, is, that's always going to be relevant. It's always going to be present, no matter how we begin to kind of distort the perception of where jazz comes from, right?
Right.
There's always going to be that DNA that then gets passed on to hip-hop. There's such a direct link, and it doesn't happen in the way that when you're trying to sell a record. So oftentimes we'll talk about, oh, the success of hip-hop, hip-hop's being taken over by X group. But in the cultural practice and the everyday vernacular spaces, you know, it's still, there's people that aren't steeped in the culture, and they'll try it on, and they'll leave, or they'll figure out a way to make a quick buck on it. Dance is a little tricky, right? Because there isn't a product. It's so ephemeral. So people that are in hip-hop dance communities, street dance communities, their commitment with their bodies in particular is different to me. It's different than, oh, I'm going to, you know, emulate or mimic or copy the sound of this rapper or this producer, and then I'm going to make some money because I've kind of figured out a formula to, you know.
It appeals to bigger audience or something.
Yeah, and there's streams, you know, there's appropriation streams that will lead you, you know, I guess people will lead them to a payday. But people discard it. So here we are, you know, 40, 50 years later with hip hop dance, and there's people globally that are still immersed in the culture, like literally in their 50s, still dancing. And that's not appropriation.
It's cool that people that age are still doing it and finding ways to express themselves. But you're here working with a younger group of people.
I am.
How is it for you as a choreographer and somebody who lives and breathes this culture, working with students who may not?
Well, this generation of student I'm working with, they can't like get away from it. Now, their level of cultural literacy, their level of understanding it through practice, through training, not necessarily just studio training, because there are a couple dancers that have community training, so they kind of grew up, they're Black, so they have a certain sort of access to some of these ideas and these modalities, and not necessarily the moves. I think a lot of people will get lost in, oh, I can figure out the shape of this dance, I can now do this dance. And dance is loaded and coded. Black dance in particular is loaded and coded. And every move has meaning. And it's not always explicit in what it means, but there's an understanding to just how a movement idea, a word, a phrase is presented in the context that if you're around it, you get it. A simple move like just the movement of the head, just bobbing forward and backward or up and down like a yes. You might see that in church. You might see that there's a variety of contexts that the learning happens, that this move right here has value. And not only does it have value, but this move right here can flow in a variety of different contexts and it can reshape its meaning. And so there's that like level of like understanding, right? And with the students at the university, for me, it's an opportunity to have a community building process, moment to moment, to come in and get an idea of Milwaukee through my experience with them in the studio and not always on the dance floor, on the side, talking and clowning and laughing. And I teach a movement system that I created called Funkamental Metakinetics. And it's really about the spiritual efficacy of Black dance practices. And at the core of it is community building. Like one of the greatest things that I love about hip-hop dance is that sense of community built around the dialogue that happens in the cipher. That's a multi-layered sort of experience. And so I can come in and have that, and I can, if it's each one teach one is the ethos, we can meet where we are. So if all of the dancers aren't necessarily trained in these hip-hop forms, I can take these modalities of making, of creating, and have a conversation with them. And this is what this piece is about. This bubbling utterance is about building community. Like, this is the immaterial sort of, like, the back story to the piece, is how do I come in and have a conversation with some amazing artists and create a space or facilitate a moment to the next moment where I can get a little glimpse of who they are and their ways of being in the world and then sculpt that into a quote-unquote dance.
So it is improvisatory in that way, using those fundamentals that you've created. So you've got this structure that supports that improv.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it is.
Are you having fun with them?
I'm having a ball. Yesterday, I must have screamed about. I'm a little special when I'm like in the process, but it's so much about people's voices, and there is a generation now that are learning hip hop, and their first experience with hip hop dance is in a dance studio. And hip-hop dance isn't necessarily a studio practice. It's still vernacular. It's still street. It's still neighborhood. It's still Auntie Junie and them having a barbecue, and it's going to happen, right? It doesn't need to be on the agenda. It's going to happen. Or community center or park, or it depends on where you travel in this country, where these dance practices happen. But the street is still the locus. And so when I work with people that come to the language a little bit differently, it's pretty fascinating. And so one thing that I've learned in my travels is that oftentimes in their studio practice, they're not allowed, or maybe it's not as valued to have their voice. They become part of this sort of ensemble. And there's something, I think, valuable in that. But one thing about street dance is the question is always, who are you? And it's not a static question. It's like, okay, I see you representing right now. And then the next round, the next time, who are you? I want to hear your voice. I want to see you. I want to hear you. I want to feel you. And this is what's nice about creating this sort of improvisational structure, is for them to have a moment to go, this is what I sound like. This is what I look like. This is what I feel like. Yo, you feel me? You feel me? You feel me? And they continue just to, every time they're there, even when they're still and supporting. There's a strong part of this piece in particular that's about witnessing. How do you just take people in? How is that part of the conversation?
Well, I am so looking forward to seeing your piece and to seeing all of the winter dances. I think it's going to be really fantastic. And I cannot thank you enough for coming in on a snowy morning to
thank
talk
so
with
much.
Us. DeSabella Grimes, thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
DeSabella Grimes is a Southern California-based choreographer and dance teacher. His meditation on Sherman Park, Bubbling Utterances, was created for this year's Winter Dances, an annual series of performances presented by UWM's Dance Department.
The performances are in the Kenilworth Building on Milwaukee's East Side tomorrow through Sunday. There's more information at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherrick encouraged us to seek out some old dining favorites here and not just that hot new restaurant down the street. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee's dining scene is vibrant enough that it's tempting to always seek out the hot new establishment. And while new can be great, Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherrick says not to forget our dining heritage.
Kyle is a fan of restaurants both old and new, and he joins us in the studio now to explain what he's getting at.
I mean, this time of year, we've taken the occasion to talk about the changes in the dining scene and the new places and what's coming and trends and so forth. And it was really... Well, the conversation that we had off mic some time ago when Carl Rausch closed, and my heart was, you know, all wrapped up in sadness relative to childhood memories and what it meant. I mean, 130-year legacy for the city and right downtown and so forth. And off of that conversation, I went back and with my wife, we made a list of all of the places that the next time we go out, we were going to choose to go to first, because if they went away... Again, we would say, well, were we waiting for a private invitation from the owner? You know, I mean,
why didn't we go?
And
because we chase the new. I mean, that's a very human thing.
Very human.
Is to chase. Oh, it's the brand new hot thing. You know, let's go check that out.
Right.
But there are some wonderful. I mean, I hate to use the word legacy restaurants, but they kind of are.
I think that's an appropriate term. I mean, whether we talk about a Ristorante in the village of Wauwatosa, which opened up in 1989, and that really set Joe and Paul Bertolotta on their path. And, you know, I love the story that if it wasn't Joe DeRosa who owned the Chanceries, who basically advocated for them, the landlord at the time didn't want an Italian restaurant because he thought it would smell like garlic all the time. I mean, imagine now how many people they've employed, how many chefs they've trained, how much just real estate tax they've paid.
And how much good food they've served.
How much good food they've served. Yeah, what they've added to the hospitality industry. It all began there, and they almost didn't get the lease. But then you can go back to someone like Three Brothers, where, you know, it's been around from the 50s. And it's gotten a James Beard Award for an American classic, which is something that's woven into the fabric of the American dining culture. They got that award in 2002. It's a national award. If Three Brothers ever closed, I, you know, Sandy D'Amato, who you've had on. I mean, when anybody asked him nationally, what's your favorite restaurant? He always said Three Brothers. It wasn't Sanford. It was Three Brothers. He said, you know, we go to Three Brothers, we go to Speed Queen, and we go to Beans and Barley. All of these are legacy restaurants, and I don't think we think of them in those terms. But Beans opened in the 70s. Polonaise opened in the 80s. Three Brothers opened in the 50s. You know, we've got this terrific dining heritage here. Even a more modest place like Mezzo's, the burger place over on the south side, that's the last vestige of a kind of a micro chain here in Milwaukee. But they opened up in 1934. And when you go into Mezzo's, you get the feeling that right about 1951, they set it in amber.
They said, this is perfect. We don't need to change it.
Yeah, but yeah. They're amazing burgers. And right across the street, so Mezzo's 70 years. Across the street is Leon's 50 years. And no offense to the Froyos of the world and what have you, but if I'm going to put my calories and my money behind a great custard experience, it's going to be one of the legacy names here in the city, right?
So what are some of the other restaurants? You mentioned Polonaise. You mentioned Three Brothers. What Sure. are some of the other places that people might have forgotten about, or if they're new to Milwaukee, they don't know about at all?
Right. So when we run down our list, so Kegel's, 1925, really started as a speakeasy soda counter, but five generations. Julian is still involved. He and his wife... friends of ours, and they make the potato pancakes the same way they've been made for, you know, 60, 70 years. And the carrot cake, which is exceptional, the Hassenpfeffer, which, like, where else are you going to get that in the city? And it's the recipe that great-grandma had. My wife was talking about the carrot cake, and she said, well, why don't you just, you know, use a Cuisinart? And she's like, oh, we wouldn't. No, we wouldn't know where to put it. Like, that's not how we make the carrot cake. We slice all of these carrots by hand.
We grate them
in. Yeah, exactly, exactly. Think of the Plaza, the cafe at the Plaza. In the 1920s, it used to be a tea room, that space, because ladies weren't allowed to, they had to have tea separate from the rest of the guests. And in 1950s, it converted to that diner kind of aesthetic. And I mean,
one of my favorite places to go have breakfast.
The breakfast is amazing. One of the best in the city.
I bring people from out of town
there. Yeah. And you go in and it's like a film set, you know? I mean, the same reason that people got attached to Downton Abbey was just to see how they lived and were served. Just go to the Plaza. It's
I think of the Ambassador the same way.
Ambassador is a great example. A great example. And that's been revived and restored. But you walk into that lobby and it's the way
it's
that
Art
it was.
Art Deco spectacular.
Yeah, the light fixtures and the solid nickel and so on and so forth. So Bryant's, 1934, America's first freestanding cocktail lounge. The Packing House, which was a Japanese-style hibachi bar way before Benihana, where the owner literally flew to Japan, recruited people, flew them back, and housed them so he could give this authentic experience. That burned down, and then Chris's parents bought it in the 70s, and it's been that ever since. I mean, you can't recreate the backstory of a great place like that. Jake's Deli, 1903, started as a butcher shop, changed into the deli in 1955. 5 o'clock Steakhouse, the history there. The Speed Queen, which started in 1956 as the Black King. She was competing with, actually, the Black King Barbecue, which was the barbecue place. And Giovanni's mom set up across the street to basically do a few items and more quickly, and that's where the name Speed Queen came from. I mean, it's superlative barbecue, and we can argue for hours about the best barbecue, but it's still great. That's Milwaukee history. That's heritage. The Jazz Estate at Random, and even places like Kaz's Mini Bowl. You know, I mean, if Kaz's ever closed, like, our kids have this experience of real pin setters. You go to Kaz's, it's magical. It's unlike anywhere else in the Midwest. Handles, Elsa's even falls under that, Von Trier's. I mean, you can make an argument for a lot of places if you just put the 25-year mark, but there's another class that goes back 60, 70, some 100, you know. Mater's, 1902, for God's sake. I mean, it's just, they have a location. A lot of people don't realize this, but when you walk the streets of old Milwaukee, the Comfort was what Mater's was originally called, and then it transitioned into long about the 30s. So it's just a heritage, and because I'm so into dining and history, there are chefs, there are GMs, there are restaurateurs, there are managers, there are cooks, there are folks that move through the fabric of these restaurants, that got their start, that got inspired, that tripped into making the dining scene what it is now.
So the connection between the old and the new, you're saying, is a very strong one.
No question. When I talk to the young Turk chefs, I guess, and I mean the ones that are opening up new places, the Dan Dans of the world, or the Birch and Butcher, or that kind of crowd, all of them, if I mention a Ristorante or a Kegels or a Three Brothers or a Polonaise, their whole demeanor changes into something that's just soft and affectionate, and they know, you know, if not for that before me, I wouldn't be here. And many of them make a point of going themselves every month or two just because they understand what it means to add those dollars to the entire flow for the restaurant. And if one of those places slipped away, there'd be more heartbreak within the culture.
Are we in danger of losing any of those?
I don't know in particular. I think, you know, Ristorante is coming up on its 25th anniversary for the Bartolotas. Three Brothers were very good friends with that family, and I don't have any, you know, concern. I don't know of any imminence, but then again, we didn't expect it with Carl Rausch.
That happened very fast.
Very quickly, and that's part of the turn on the dime aspect of the restaurant culture. So I'm not saying don't go to the new places, because we need that energy. They're beloved. People are working very hard. But when you're thinking about where should we go, for many people, it's being a tourist in your own town, right? And you can't get better Polish cuisine than Polonaise. You can't get a better brunch than going to the Plaza. You can't get a better sort of supper club experience without a long, long drive than going to the Packing House. Kegels, you can't get the Hassenpfeffer
anywhere else.
Yes. These are the flavors of our heritage and our history. Or even if it's just a novelty, go, and I guarantee you're going to find it delicious. And again, like I said about the frozen, you know, yogurt places popping up. I mean, look, when Paul Bartolotta brings famous chefs into Milwaukee, the first place he takes him is one of our custard stands. And that says everything. This is unique. This is our heritage. These are the flavors of who we are. So let's keep these places open, because it's part of our culinary tradition.
Well, you're going to give us a list, right? So
yes.
We can put it on the website.
Yes.
Of the ones that you recommend. And then it would be great if people would say, well, what about this place?
Yeah, yeah.
Don't forget this place.
And that's just it. It's an emotional list. And I am by no means the authority, but I want it to be a springboard for people to think and add in and say on and so forth, and realize, oh, I have deep memories there and the food's still good. So why shouldn't we go?
Well, let's go eat.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Kyle. Thanks so much, and we will talk again soon.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Kyle Cherik is host of Wisconsin Foodie on public television and a regular Lake Effect contributor. You'll find more of our interviews with him at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then hear some music from one of the groups playing Friday night as part of the 5th Annual Milwaukee Gospel Jubilee. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Gospel, it is music to wake up to, music that gets you off your seat, music that makes you want to raise your arms and cheer with elation.
Charisse Love, Jaquan Quan Clark, and Sean Winston are no stranger to the joy that gospel brings. They are part of a quartet called Spiritual Tones, representing a next generation of gospel singers in Milwaukee. They are performing at the 5th Annual Milwaukee Gospel Jubilee on Friday night.
They stop by with Jubilee organizer John Seeger to speak with Lake Effect's Mayon Silver and to sing some tunes.
But sometimes at night, when I'm all alone, I can talk to Jesus on my telephone. When I'm sad, he makes me smile. I be talking just me and my God and I. Nobody but me, my God and I. Thank you, Jesus. Nobody but me, my God and I. Good God Almighty. Nobody but me, my God and I. Thank you, Jesus. Nobody but me, my God and I. Nobody, nobody, nobody but me, my God and I. Stay right there. Nobody but me, my God and I. Nobody, nobody, nobody but me, my God and I. When I'm all alone, nobody but me, my God and I. Good God Almighty, nobody but me, my God and I.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right.
Yeah, that was really great.
You make it look easy.
Yeah, that was beautiful, mellifluous, melodic. Well, first of all, I wanted to say welcome to all four of you guys to
Thank
Lake
you.
Effect.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming yes. by. Where did you first get into gospel music?
In the early 90s, a friend of mine said the Masonic Wonders, a group that's been together only maybe 60 years, two original members, they said they needed a guitar player. So I found myself in these churches that were very unlike the ones I grew up in. Because I grew up in a Catholic church, so there was no Gregorian chant in these churches. But there was something that sounded a lot like rock and roll and blues and just all the exciting music in America. So, and it was gospel, because that's where it all comes from.
How did you guys get into gospel music? Was it just in the blood? How did that happen?
My mom was singing with the Queens of Harmony for over 30 years, and they've been together for 50-something years. So she would always have me in church, and I would always get up on stage with them and just stand by them. And then, like, eventually I just started singing. So I've been in church, like, all my life, so it's something that's in the blood, really.
Can you describe what it's like being in church when people are doing gospel?
It's normal to me, so it's like...
What about for someone who's never experienced it?
They would think it would be different, like, if it's their first time seeing it. Like,
I can tell you because I wasn't raised in that church, and I came in, and I can tell you right now, if my church had been like that, I came in, and stage and altar are almost the same thing. The stage looks like a stage that I'm used to. It has amps and drums and a bass amp and keyboards and a PA. And then when they play, it's a fine line between gospel, which is kind of the originator, and all the music I love. So mm-hmm. I'd probably still be going to that church. So, and for me, and a crowd sang along and clapped, and someone like Charisse, I knew her when she was probably, 11 or 12, mm-hmm. younger, but even younger than her. Someone will get up to sing, and the whole crowd will support them. If they can't find it out, they'll be yelling, "You can do it, you can do it." Am I right?
Yeah.
It's very supportive atmosphere. And in a lot of other cultures, like mine, you can have the desire to sing laughed out of you. It happened to people I know. I'm married to one, so. And she's a good singer.
So Quan, when you sing gospel, like, what are these reactions like in the churches that you're singing in?
Normally, when I'm singing in different places, it's pretty good. Everybody loves to hear me sing, and yeah, so it's pretty good.
Did you get into it through a different style of music or straight gospel?
No, both of my grandparents, they are pastors and bishops, and since I've been little, been in church nonstop. My aunties, they sing, and I was getting up with them singing, and from there it went on and on. Then I got in a group over here and continued to go, so it's just natural for us.
And Sean, you too?
Yes, I've been in it all my life. I'm the newbie in the group. They adopted me, so I'm very happy that they did and very excited. So when I'm out singing, it just do something to me. It makes my bones just quiver. I just love it. I really love it. I'm very excited all the time. So I just be like, come on, let's do this. Let's get out here. Let's do this.
And that is him.
Yes.
And is it the lyrics or is it the music? Are you doing a lot of a cappella? Are you working with choirs? What are you doing?
We do a cappella if our musicians can't make it, but a lot of the songs that we do is usually music. Like, we just wrote a song. All our music is music. Unless we have to do a cappella like this, then.
Today? Then you work with a bunch of instruments?
Yes.
And how many singers would be singing at once in church on Sunday morning?
As far as this group, it's four singers. It's a lead and then three background.
There's a tradition in gospel music of quartet singing. In its own way, it's formalized. There are certain harmonies that are right and certain ones that are wrong. And again, they're all the harmonies I love. And yes. they do everything just right, and it's all a folk tradition. It's something that you learn as a little kid, like all of them did. You don't go to school for this, mm-hmm. but you're actually studying your whole life, and by the time you're in your early 20s or even late teens, you're one of the best musicians or singers in town, and it's just a fact. This town is full of great singers and players who have all learned through this folk tradition, an oral tradition that goes way back. And if you can imagine singing the songs your grandparents sang and they're still alive and ongoing, I can't, because you know I would probably be singing Lawrence Welk or
right.
something like that. And for me it had to move on, but it's already there and it's already good.
So how do you guys take your own spin, or do you take your own spin on things if yeah. this is such a long tradition of music?
Well, yeah, we kind of take our own spins because, like you said, it's quartet, but we're younger and we're more energized. Yeah. So we add our own little twists to different songs and things. Like, for instance, if we're writing a song, we play around a little bit, and then whatever we plan around with, it started to sound good, and we just started to make up a song with it, and that's how we got our first song out. So
there's some improvising.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, wow, that's cool. So did you guys ever study jazz officially or anything like that, or you just it came naturally?
For me, it came natural. For me,
Sean, I listen to all types of music. So from listening to jazz, R&B, rock and roll, you know, I kind of take different ideas and kind of put them together and come up with something unique. So that's the thing for me. I love it.
And that's the thing. Gospel is making it into mainstream culture. I don't know if you guys heard Chance the Rapper's Blessings song.
Oh, yeah,
and
I heard it.
Yeah, that's a good song. And, you know, do you guys take other influences? You were talking about jazz and R&B. Are there anything like Charisse? Would there be a style that you especially like when you're not being influenced by gospel?
I like old school music, but I like R&B music. So other than gospel, I just listen to R&B music. I don't really listen to my time of music.
And she likes a lot of old school music.
Yes.
So yeah, the old school, Sam Cooke, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles,
the people right there.
It goes on and on and on.
Yes.
They were all gospel singers who crossed over. So they also had the same experience as this group had of learning in church. And most gospel groups stay in church. But when they cross over, there's a lot of great artists that come out of that and share it with the whole country and the world.
So how does the Christian nature of it or the spiritual nature of it play in for you guys? Being young, you know, a lot of young people are becoming more secular these days, maybe not going to church. Mm-hmm. How does this music tie in with religion or spirituality?
I'll let you answer that.
I guess because I was born around it and so used to singing gospel that it's just something natural. Not saying that other music is bad, because everybody has their own choice of music, but far as gospel, it just depends on like your faith and religion, of course, and I don't know, something different.
We all believe in Jesus, so we want to keep him with us wherever we go. So we may say a prayer before we do anything,
mm-hmm.
sing, whatever, but we want to keep him with us always. That's the number one thing right there.
And do you think gospel music can also be, you can connect to it even if you're not connecting to the religious aspect of it?
Yes. I know some people that's not, say
that's
a Christian or whatever,
church.
Yeah, and like a song will touch them and they'll be like, oh, this touched my heart, or, you know, the message got to me. Like, I don't believe you have to be a Christian in order for a message to get through to you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Where do you guys see gospel music going? You know, you're going to take it places. Where do you see for that?
Gospel music is everywhere, but we want to keep it alive, and then we want to make it our own in our own style. So we don't want to keep it the same, so we want to come and mix it up. So when we go other places, we will stick with them like, oh, I like They sound different and alive. I want to keep it that
enjoy,
way.
Enjoy.
Yes, mm-hmm. And enjoy. There we go.
Because we're young, and a lot of young people, they think that being in church is not fun, but we're here. You can be young and have fun in church at the same time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have our own little style and everything, so.
Is there one moment that you think, remember being in church, a particular church here in Milwaukee, that it was like the epitome of just rip-roaring gospel music?
You know, one of the things I've noticed is that gospel always delivers that. It's like it can be ecstatic and crazy happiness, you know, high energy, all the things you're talking about. And it often is pretty reliably that. We've done these gospel brunches at Colectivo leading up to the Jubilee, and we've done those, I think, for 4 years. It might be three or four, but I used to worry about them because sometimes people would show up late. It's not like regular showbiz. It doesn't have quite the same rules, and I'd be, you know, sweating bullets hoping everyone gets there. And there isn't one of them that didn't end like you just described, with them pretty much, you know, at a high energy level with the roof lifting off that building. I mean, it's nuts, and it's very joyous and dependably joyous music.
Are there any lyrics in particular to any particular gospel piece that really speaks to you guys? Or a simple set of lyrics that you can think of? They use psalms, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything with Jesus keep me, Jesus hold my hand, anything like that moves me because that's what I need.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Keep me, Lord. Keep me.
For me, it's a song called Satisfied. It's basically telling you if everything that you plan on doing fails, if you don't get your house, you don't get the car that you want, your dreams never come true, will you be satisfied with God? And that kind of speaks to me. So that's mine for me.
Wow. That's really nice.
I think take your burdens to the Lord because, you know, it's a lot going on in the world. And I just think that the Lord, He listens, of course, and He can solve all your problems. I feel like you shouldn't have to worry. You just take all your problems to Him, and He'll fix it either now or when He feels
He's
that it's necessary.
He's always on time.
Yeah.
Amen.
Nice. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank
and
you.
Singing.
Thank
and
you for having
us.
Yes.
Yeah. I stopped by to tell somebody he did not wake me up early this morning.
The quartet Spiritual Tones performs as part of Milwaukee Gospel Jubilee on Friday night at Turner Hall. It is a fundraiser for Progressive Community Healthcare. They were joined by organizer John Seeger, and they spoke with Mayon Silver. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
Wake me up early this morning, but he did. He did not start me on my way, but he did. But he did. I could have been dead in my grave, but you made old Dev stand back and behave. So glad, so glad, I'm glad, so glad. Oh Lord, so glad he did.